clearly you've already been spending a great deal of time reading the text. And what we thought maybe would be a good way to start, to kind of jump in, would maybe be to go around and perhaps share with us and share with each other how you would go about defining peace in relation to the text, in relation to contemporary geopolitical events, in relation to your own practice. And although we're all kind of sitting next to each other, Martin, Greg, and I, fundamentally we see this as a conversation with each other. So unlike last night, where we were really moving and directing the conversation, we'd actually like to think of this as more a very different kind of methodology, a different format, where it's just a conversation back and forth. So rather than look to us to respond to you, maybe just look to each other. I don't know if you guys want to say anything else, and if you just want
to
jump.
No, it'd be good just to have people go around. I mean, it's the opening statements or the statements that you made, but also you see several attempts here, several definitions, let's say, that have engaged different notions of what peace are. So it's not just simply peace, but it's also this concept of perpetual peace, or the question of sustainable, whether we call it eternal, perpetual, sustainable. Each of our discourses today have something that, as Csikszentmihalyi said at the last, it was Elaine Csikszentmihalyi in the last segment, that there has to be a horizon to any finite determination or temporal determination of peace. Without that horizon, then peace, in a sense, has no time. There's no relationship between this peace and a more final state of peace. So.
Okay. Should I say my name first?
Yeah.
I'm Lynn. Throughout the whole movie thing, they were just everybody. All the people who started trying to define peace actually just said what peace was not. So peace is not this. Peace is not only absence of war. Peace is not something. But nobody really gives you a defined, limited, precise definition of peace. So it's still this concept that's like up in the air that you're trying to grasp, but you really can't. And then the other idea that I was interested in me is like the idea of perpetual. Does that mean if it's perpetual, that's the absence of motion? Does that mean that it doesn't evolve, that it doesn't change? And then if you write those two ideas, if you think about a piece and you try to define it, it's like you, in some sort of way, you stop it, because when you like limit it into one definition, it can stop it from change. So that's when you, it becomes a more concrete, but also kind of eternal and non-changeable concept.
I'm Lowell. I sort of define peace in a sort of international relations sense, sort of the end of the peace would be the end of anarchy. It would be where states actually trusted each other enough to avoid what Kant talks about at the beginning, where they hold back, where they hold their reservations for the next conflict, for the next war, and the notion that it would be perpetual is not. I disagree with the sense that perpetual would mean staying in place. Perpetual to me would be that it would be peace that would be peace that would constantly be reforming itself on retaining new trust in the system. It's like perpetual peace would be the notion that that states would continue investing in retaining that newfound trust.
May I just ask the two of you, because you I think it's fascinating that you talk about perpetuality, and you introduce also a notion, a negative notion of it, or at least a possibility, I think, which Kant is also talking and mentioning, that there is actually the possibility of a piece of, as he calls it, of the cemetery. I mean, do you also see that as a sort of danger what he calls the peace of the cemetery, or the despotic peace?
I think yes. From my personal experience, I'm Tunisian, so I'm sure that you all saw what happened in Tunisia. And for 23 years, peace for us was like a contract with authorities, you know. It's like if you...
That's fascinating. What was the contract? What were the terms of the contract?
Well, basically, if you shut up and not defy the authorities, you can live in security and you can have stability. So peace became that kind of price that that you had to give up your freedoms and your basic rights for.
Peace is an order. Yeah.
Yeah. So
was the word peace used in official?
Yeah. Like word peace, and also as a synonym of it, stability and security. Mm. So it wasn't like, it wasn't peace in the religious way or peace in like a non-war state, but more of a like a
civil security.
Exactly. No chaos, no anarchy. Mm. So.
Fascinating. I mean, there's definitely a difference between what I would describe as perpetual peace and complacent peace, because the complacent peace is what you just described. It's like just this notion that if we keep everything in line now and keep anything from changing, keep any problems from being brought up, we will have peace. But the danger of a complacent peace is that the society doesn't evolve. It doesn't evolve, and inequalities and problems aren't discussed, and it becomes despotic peace.
Let me just follow up one thing before we go to the next person, but to follow up what Martin said, both of you introduced movement or the absence of movement, in a sense, that definition. And do you see that? And you just described as complacency could be to be the absence of something evolving in society, whether it's a political system. So you see that as a necessary aspect of the perpetual peace, is a constant movement towards some goal, or
I see the goal of the perpetual peace should be to evolve to continue solving problems instead of letting them fester and then and making them endanger the peace because complacent peace ignores what could end it. Movement is necessary simply for the survival of the peace.
I'm Nora. And I kind of agree with what Lowell was saying. I think that peace is kind of this ability to consistently and constantly evolve to meet the needs of our global society and the people in it. And I think I maybe take a somewhat idealistic view of peace, because peace for me truly means that everyone has the opportunity to seek out what they want to seek out, whether that be an education or a career or a leadership role. I think that when people don't have those opportunities, that's what causes anger, that's what causes dissatisfaction, and that's what leads to violence. And I think that if there was a way that society kind of adjust itself to meet the needs of people who don't have the opportunities that, say, we have in the United States, that people would be a lot more willing to move towards a more peaceful society, a more or a less anarchic society, I think.
I think it's fascinating that you put the emphasis somehow on society, which is in the text as well, and not so much on the international system and on the relationship between states, but you look at it as in terms of peace as a concept within society and the necessary conditions for it.
I mean, I think that it's important to look at the, you know, the big picture and look at the international scene, I suppose, but peace really can't extend internationally, I don't think, unless it exists already within individual societies. Like, I think that, and I disagree that I don't think it should be this way, but I think right now that peace is kind of a concept of privileged countries, countries that have less pressing problems kind of in their immediate vision. So if society, if each individual society were able to move past those problems, then I think we could perhaps reach the level of a global international discussion of what it truly means to have a peaceful world.
You both have used the term anarchy in a very interesting way, in the same way that I think Kant refers to a state of nature as anarchy or lawlessness, or so. Do you mean to oppose, which seems to imply that peace is some presence of an established system of government or established system of relationships that are governed and ordered in some way? Is that lawful? So, what do you think?
I wouldn't say that it's necessarily governed or has law involved, but rather kind of what how Lowell defined it, this ability for everyone to come together and not necessarily worry about their own, you know, sovereignty and their own independence, but be willing to maybe make sacrifices to their independence, to build a better, more unified society. So rather than having, you know, each government looking out for themselves, having them more willing to make compromises and work together.
And what would be then the element that would be necessary in order for that to happen?
I don't know.
I think there would have to be an ability of states to actually trust each other. There would be, I mean, it's hard to imagine that without some sort of overarching body, but there would have to be some sort of informal acceptance of trust within the community that you could actually reach out for a helping hand and somebody would go out and somebody would help you without threatening your sovereignty. It's like thinking, gaining concessions from you, thinking primarily in their interests, and it's like an actual plea for help would get answered without entirely the considerations of national interests.
But I think that begins with accepting the humanity that exists in all human beings. And I think that's where we're flawed. And that's like the element that's missing, is seeing that kind of, you opened your presentation yesterday with that kind of clip from Kant about the idea that an international affair affects us all, and that we are all connected to each other in this whole cosmopolitan idea. And that is what we have to accept. And that there is humanity in all of us. Each person has a value, has a worth. And that comes, and accepting that will eventually, I mean, ideally will lead to that knowing that someone else will be there, that you can reach out, and that help will be there because you, too, are connected to this world in the end of the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what about understanding? Just like merely taking the effort to understand cultures and our differences among each other, because I think so many of our problems today, I mean, we can... it stem from our lack of effort or our lack of true understanding of the other side? Like, why do we have these issues? What are their goals? Are we able to really express our goals to somebody else, or do we even have a problem with that? Because I think true dialogues really begin when you sort of let those boundaries fall and you just have a true human conversation with somebody else.
What I think is interesting is that for that ability to open up and allow yourself to explore other cultures and empathize with other cultures, I think an aspect of security is necessary within your own culture. And so when they're talking about peace as a concept of security, you wonder, can that kind of peace then lead to more of an understanding? But I think it brings us to this more circular notion between a negative peace, as in the lack of war, and a positive peace, as in more normalist, saying how peace is more than just not having to deal with war, but it's having the opportunity of basic rights, I think, and not just civil rights or political rights, but socioeconomic rights too. And I think they kind of feed into each other, where when you feel secure, as there is no war, that allows the opportunity to pursue those other rights. And when you do have a positive peace, it definitely helps prevent war. So
do you see... And this kind of refers back to the beginning, when all of the different spokespeople who were on the film segment could only provide a negative definition of peace, and you just talked about a negative definition of peace as being somehow related to security. I mean, security is necessary as a condition for developing a positive definition of peace that means trust, confidence, connection, you know, relationship, community, all of those things. So you think that historically, you think that law functions to establish at least, it has that aspiration to globally establish at least a security as the basis for developing a more positive understanding of peace?
I think it could. And I think it could also work in the opposite direction, that law could work to establish a positive peace in helping citizens have rights, and then that could help resolve negative peace issues. Like, I don't think it's, you know, mm-hmm. a one-way direction. I think they both go back and forth.
Okay. Why don't we continue around the table, though, with the introduction?
All right. Well,
you are next.
I guess I just kind of talked about my notion of peace. I definitely think of positive peace as an important thing to keep in mind. And I took a human rights class. Mm-hmm. And so that was a big thing of what we talked about. And also, going along the whole understanding thing, the issue of multiculturalism and cultural relativism, I thought was interesting reading, or maybe it was hearing a speaker talk about how we can't allow cultural relativism to, as an excuse for allowing certain behaviors. But at the same time, I think we need to allow cultural relativism to temper, you know, a desire for an absolute concept of human rights. I was also taking an anthropology class at the same time, so it was really interesting to have the two perspectives, because a lot of the issues with implementing human rights around the world is that people have different concepts of them.
Can I just ask a question? What do you think of, in your reading of Context, what do you think of his perception of rights, you know, human rights, or even the anthropological questions?
I haven't completely read the text, mm-hmm. actually. I haven't. I only skimmed it. So I don't really know how he addressed it. Sorry.
I'm Mariah. And like Allison said, I think that peace is sort of like a contract between humans to respect the humanity in each of us, regardless of, you know, where you're from, like what nation you belong to. And I think it might be a little idealistic, but I think it's important because we all do sort of belong to this earth. And I think that the issues with respecting the humanity and others comes from, like, the lack of understanding natural differences in, like, race and gender, and then educational differences. I think
all of those things make it really easy to put somebody down or to just not listen. And I think opening up a dialogue is a much better way of solving a conflict than necessarily taking away the rights of others. And I don't think peace is necessarily the absence of conflict, but I do think it is, like, I guess, a more civil way to resolve a conflict.
All right. I'm Allison, and I guess, like, when I was trying to figure out how I wanted to define peace, like, my biggest problem was that I thought saying peace was the absence of war was really what I wanted to say peace was, but in this day and age, we turn to war immediately, and so this whole idea that if you want, I feel like saying peace was the absence of war was giving peace a definition that was unattainable, and that if you want peace to occur, you need to have it in stages. This idea that you can't say it's the absence of conflict, it's that you want peace to be the ability to not immediately look to war being the solution, to looking for dialogue, to acknowledging humanity that exists in others, to want to reach out, and I guess, like, dialogue was what I thought peace was that this ability to talk to others and acknowledge each other, and that saying it was the absence of war was one too big of a concept, but impossible to kind of say when there's a war going on at all times.
When you say dialogue, who are the parties in the dialogue?
I think kind of what Nora was talking about, it can be both in society itself, but both international. I think, and this idea that I think it's this. It's what we're doing now. It's talking to each other, and I guess we're all from different places, all different grades, and that is peace. That is acknowledging each other, and that it also can occur when, I guess, like, on a global scale, it's two nations willing to sit down with each other and take that risk, and risking this idea of security, and that maybe it's not going to war immediately to react and to protect yourself, but is there something to gain with talking and seeing what is there another solution? And that's the first step, I think.
There's another way. I mean, we come around to the negative definition of peace, the absence of war. There's another way of thinking about that too, which is related to policy, which is parabellum. It's not that the war is absent, but it's virtual always. In other words, the best way to ensure peace is to constantly prepare for war. So if you have an armed and militarized state, then it's likely to remain in a state of peace because the neighbor will not attack that state out of fear of the consequences. So that's another way of thinking about absence, is also that virtual idea of war that we live with. Do you see that as
I don't like that. I mean, that was my immediate reaction was, I mean, Kant says it. I mean, when we read his essay for my sovereignty class, and we were looking at, well, what is needed to create this ideal government, and is it the absence of a standing army? And I was like, well, how can you do that? This idea that you want to do that. I don't want to look at peace as that everyone has an army, therefore you're all going to fear each other,
right?
Because that isn't constructive. That's hiding. That's be internalizing rather than expressing what needs to occur, I think.
Well, that would that be a negative definition of? I mean, if everybody had an army and people just didn't have war, would that be peace? Because they were afraid of the consequences out of self-interest in some way. Yeah.
I think that's really what Kant talks about with the problem with peace treaties, is that you're kind of just putting it on pause, mm-hmm. and waiting for it to come. It's, you can have 50 years of peace and no one's fighting, but it doesn't go away. You're simply just putting it away for later.
I mean, this was in reality, that was the situation of the Cold War, and that's why it was called Cold War. I mean, this is, there was actually, particularly in my continent, in Europe, there was very little armed conflict, or almost no armed conflict, because there was a balance of deterrence and of horror. And then when the Cold War was over, then in Europe the conflicts actually emerged and broke out, and armed conflict broke out.
I always tell my students when I'm teaching is that do you know what the motto of the Strategic Air Command is, the U.S. Air Force? Peace is our profession. And that was invented in 1952 during the beginning of the Cold War. So it's always it's ironic to keep that in mind.
Yeah, I'm Jeff. And I think it's really interesting how it seems like everyone, not even every culture, but even every individual has a different concept or definition of peace. Probably for the first 18 years of my life, my concept of peace was lack of war. But I took this really interesting class, a peace studies class in high school, where my teacher, Coleman McCarthy, sort of showed me how peace is more than just a state in which nations aren't fighting each other, but it's also more of a mindset and sort of more of just this culture of acceptance and that, yeah, it's more than just putting off conflicts for the future, but it's thinking about you know, how could a conflict arise and how could we deal with it, and also sort of ways of mediating conflicts nonviolently. I really like the idea of peace as a mindset, and the best part of the Kant piece for me is when he says, act so that you can will that your maxim ought to become a universal law. And if everyone's maxim is this idea of peace, and everyone acts so that this maxim could become a universal law, then I think then we can really start thinking about perpetual peace, because if everyone sort of tries to be the change that they want to see in the world in that sense, then I think we can all develop a more trusting mindset and resolve conflicts peacefully.
That's a very powerful statement on Kant's part, and it's related to his categorical imperative in some ways, because it's as if everybody was the lawgiver. In other words, we didn't wait for the legislator or the state, we didn't empower the state with the authority to make law, but we acted as if we were the we were responsible for the law. So as if you were creating the law that everybody would have to obey that law, then you would have to be ultimately responsible for the very society that you create with that law.
Would you argue, I think this is a fascinating idea, and indeed if everybody would act that way, that we would have a peaceful and ideal world, but the problem is we cannot be sure, I mean, as an individual actor, that the others will act that way too.
Yeah.
So do you think in such a setting, where we do distrust each other, where we have the absence of full trust, of absence of understanding, the absence of social and economic security, the absence of universal respect of human rights, or even
too much secrecy.
Yes, yeah. Or even a universal understanding of what human rights are, the question of cultural relativism. Did you think that this idea of acting in a way that we think it should become a universal rule should anyway be pursued by states? I think it can become a very practical question. There's a conflict, and you have a set of options how to act as a state. Should you act only in terms of negotiating with the other one, you know, a tit for tat kind of thing? Only if the other party moves or the other state moves, then I will do the same. Or should I always act in a kind of universalist moral way, as if this were to become a rule? And I think this is a question I don't have an answer for, but that's probably a question that policymakers, President Obama, for example, has to face every time he makes an executive decision.
Yeah, well, international relations theory sort of addresses this in the sense that they argue that states, or I guess even non-states, stand the most to gain from cooperation in the long term, while states in the short term might defect from the overall cooperation. And they might seek defection as the easy way out because they don't trust other states. They realize that after, you know, a few times when they've exercised this choice to defect rather than cooperate with the system, they realize that if they did just settle their differences and cooperate in the long term, then that would be mutually beneficial more so than if the states just looked out for their own interests. So I think that's how what Kant said can be applied to states in the real world.
I'm Justin, and I too also struggled with the how to define peace. I tried to think of something that Kant would be like satisfied with, and I really couldn't do it. I mean, I feel that peace is the elimination of war as an option for statesmen, not just the absence of it, but the elimination of it of war as something that we use to settle differences or problems. When I think about applying that to the world today, I really struggle with seeing that happening. But then again, at the same time, this was brought up in the video, if we don't consider that type of dream or that type of idealism, then what exactly are we doing anyway? I mean, we need to strive for something. Even if it's not necessarily, if we don't believe that it's attainable, we have to be okay with trying, at least. And I prefer the idea of sustainable peace, because I think it implies a communal effort where everybody's responsible for something to keep it alive. Because if we're not constantly engaging in it, I feel like it can die. And so that's why I really prefer the idea of sustainability, and because we can all play a part in keeping it moving forward and helping it evolve. Mm-hmm.
I thought it was fascinating, all the list of definitions that you made, which I think are very convincing, and I think Kant would certainly agree that these elements are all there and necessary to establish perpetual or eternal or sustainable peace. I would like to know another thing that Kant discusses throughout the text, which is the difference or non-difference between theory and practice. It's a theme in the text. And would you think that, let's say, that there is actually a difference, you know, let's say, between all these goals that we strive for, and then if you want to put them to practice, you can, in a sense, forget the theory because it doesn't work? Or do you think that theory and practice are in unison?
I think theory has to be, like, the long-term goal that the practice is aiming for, because without sort of that idealistic without that like idealistic vision of what you want, I think you will never even get close to it in practice. There's constantly that desire to go back to what you know is safe, to what you know works, and so far that's been war or conflict or taking away the rights of others. So I think theory is important as a long-term goal. And
it's like a compass.
Yeah, and then
you
have to take practical means to get there. And I don't think within our lifetime we'll see peace, because I don't think as a society and as a world we're ready for it yet, to just to eliminate war as an option, like you said. But I do think that taking steps to get there is actually a really big step to making.
It's interesting, in the statement you made, you have already posited that it's possible, maybe not in your lifetime, maybe not in this generation's lifetime, but you have an idea of the peace as a reality, but a reality that remains distant, and positing a kind of historical evolutionary process in order to reach that point. So is that theory? Is that where do we have that knowledge from? I mean, are we not gods? We're not looking into the future and saying, you know, that's, we know the peace will be realizable at that point.
I think if you look at history and you look at things that seemed impossible at the time, and they took years to get to, peace is not such an extraordinary goal that it can't eventually happen. But I do think that if you push things too soon, that makes it so that it'll never happen, so that people just are very hesitant to approach it again. I don't think you can push people past their ideological limit too soon.
Or perhaps it relates to what you were saying. There's another kind of peace, which is equivalent to order, which is enforced. There's security or peace that's enforced, but then people will not tolerate that.
Yeah. When you were talking about how laws could enforce peace, actually, it made me think that the only way that those laws could enforce peace is actually because they have the threat of aggression. That if you actually break that law that is supposed to enforce peace, you are going to be in, not in a state of war, but in a state of conflict. So either physically or morally. And
there's an interesting parallel between that and what I describe as parabellum, which mm-hmm. is the policy by which world peace is arranged today by states, meaning preparation for war is the threat of violence constantly. Mm-hmm. That has the same structure in some way as repression within a given society. So it's as if the world system is repressive of other states. Yeah. Is that how you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not only the world system, but even people in between themselves. We didn't. That when she said that we're not ready yet, I think that I also think that we're not ready because ideologically speaking, we are still in a deep fear of the other. If just as a person, or as a state, as a culture, as a non-self. So we always think that if there's always that, caution to deal with who's different or who's not me, because you always think that if there's always that possibility that they will step over you or they will, aggress you, and you need that law to be present there so that the same person will feel the same fear if they will actually step on you or, just threaten you. So you need that law because you're not into an intellectual level yet where you can dismiss that threat.
That's a fascinating idea. Yeah. So For Kant, the idea of the law is essential in the rule of the law within society and then within the international system. But you say kind of a real state of peace can only achieved if we pass that stage that we need laws, which I think is a fascinating idea.
Yeah, because
maybe laws are temporary or placeholders for an understanding, or a natural understanding later.
Yeah, because if there's something that I learned this winter break when I went back home, and when I saw that country that I lived there my whole life and I never thought what happened was possible, but just the fact that that fear, the same fear that you have for laws, the same fear that you have for authority, it can go like this. In 1 second, it can be, it can vanish. And once it vanishes, there's a big risk that you're not going to have, it's not like you're not going to have peace or security. And it's total anarchy. For a few weeks, it was total anarchy. It was people in the streets, they didn't fear policemen, they didn't even fear to die. They were just there, they did not have arms or did not have weapons, and they did not fear to be shot by the police, which they were. They only cared about getting rid of that system that was oppressing them for years and years. So the idea of peace is not sustainable. It's not going to last. If law is needed every time to enforce security, to enforce peace, to enforce stability, peace is not going to last, basically.
But what about, I think it is a fascinating idea, but what about, you're basically saying that the laws in Tunisia, you're thinking of your own country, were only respected because the people feared them or feared the system behind it. And once the system kind of blew away, there was anarchy. And are you saying that this was a good moment, or do you it was not? Was this a sustainable moment? This state of lawlessness, is this what we want to achieve, or
I think it's a transitional moment. Whether it's going to be a transitional moment from a set of laws that were oppressive to a set of laws that are more, that are still laws, but they're not less oppressive, or it's going to be a transitional moment from dictatorship to total anarchy, we still don't know. It's still too early to determine. But that anarchy was necessary to overcome that you know, system that was established there for years and years. And you know, that anarchy was only possible when people overcame their fear of laws.
So yeah, it's really interesting. I was thinking about this in the Kantian text. The states of anarchy are actual places of transition. So he talks about the open oceans, that places where there can be no law. So he actually makes that exact equivalence, that states that undergo anarchy, revolutionary periods, or stable, a place of lawlessness, it is a period of lawlessness that's comparable to a vast desert or ocean in which there's no order or system on it. So it could be exactly what you say, that transitional relationship.
It's, I mean, it's uncertainty. Like you have no, basically you cannot determine what's going to happen next. You have no nothing. Like when I was at home and I was sitting there, like just a few seconds before I saw on TV that Ben Ali left, like our president left, I could never have thought that he would actually leave. It's like you don't know in like the next second what's going to happen. And then one the other day, after that for like 3 days, my mom wakes me up and she's like, wake up, wake up, Libya is going to invade us. So there's like, obviously Libya did not invade us, but there's still that like fear that anything can happen now, anything is possible. So
I think it's interesting that we're discussing this lack of, this potential lack of law, because kind of going back to what Jeff said, Kant brings up this point that, you know, like you should live your life by these kind of personal laws that can be applied to everyone else. And he also, Kant also brings up this idea of kind of the classic love your neighbor as thyself kind of thing. And I think it's important to distinguish between laws put in place by an outside source and the laws that you govern yourself by, because if everyone governs themselves by these moral institutions, then I really don't think there is a need for law as instituted by a government. Because if people are, for example, with the Ten Commandments, if people live by the Ten Commandments and they follow them, you know, they follow them properly and they don't make exceptions to the rule, because doing so means that everyone can make an exception to the rule, then everyone is living by this moral code that in itself perpetuates peace. And I think it's kind of interesting how law has become, in so many cases, this tool of oppression and this tool of that people use to gain power and to control other people rather than trying to better.
You raise a really important point that it brings up the different etymological and sources of the concept of peace. Some, many of them are continue to be religious sources, are very archaically and still in contemporary senses. Serenity, contemplate, you know, the notions of pact. That is the restful mind or the transformed individual person or state of, a state, as you said, a state of mind or a mindset. Refers to that. So we could think of the religious, internalized religious notion of peace means the transformation of a person that then is not led to violence in their daily lives and activities. Whereas that seems to be opposed, and I think this is one of the things that Kant was raising, to a modern and secular sense of peace that's more legally determined and externally determined, as something it has something to do with the view towards the human being as not being capable of being converted to a religious sense.
But I do have a problem with the term, with the idea of these morals coming from religion, because I don't know, I recognize that, you know, we are given these moral codes by our religions, but so much conflict stems from religion.
And I really wish that, I think that it's important to internalize these rules that we should live by, and these, you know, like thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not, you know, covet what thy neighbor, I don't know them exactly, but, you know, like those, I think those things are very important. But I think you run into trouble when you let them become anything more than a moral code to live by. I think when you start to try to use those ideas to find exceptions to the rule or to impose your own authority on someone else because you're trying to better their lives. Like, I think that this moral code is very important to own as your own. But once you start to try and put that on other people, you become a violation of peace. And I think that's another kind of interesting definition of peace as well, is not interfering with every individual's life and idea of peace. Like, the fact that we're having this discussion means that we can all accept that there are different ideas of peace, and they all mean peace, and we should all strive to reach that level of peace. But I'm not trying to, you know, to say, like, my version is the best or something like that.
I think this is fascinating. I mean, the idea of religions, you know, being either a tool or for peace or being a tool for war, mm-hmm. One can think of religion in a larger sense and also include ideologies, which sometimes behave like religions in that way that you described, in imposing one's own ideological beliefs on other people in that absolutist mm-hmm. way. And I think for Kant, there is an element where he talks about it very, very briefly in a little commentary where he talks about whether we can hope for peace or not. He kind of says that the differences in religions are a clever tool of nature mm-hmm. to bring man apart, and actually he sees them at the same time as tools of war, and at the same time as providing us, giving us the idea for some sort of universal religion that is no longer Christianity or Islam or Judaism, but is probably a religion of reason. I mean, he doesn't really spell it out.
Peace itself could be a religion.
Or peace mm-hmm. itself, mm-hmm. yeah, governed by reason. Yeah. I think what Kant would say.
Mm-hmm. You remember, according to Kant's outline towards the end, which is, I hope you understand that his vision of the design of nature is somewhat crazy or fantastic, because it's that nature uses war and religion to disperse people around the globe, which, given that it is limited and curved, and here it's important to keep in mind that Kant at that moment put aside the notion that we could colonize other planets, because then that would not lead to his theory, you know, that we could continue to disperse ourselves, you know, around the universe and still be at war. But that in the end, it's that dispersal through religion, that religion
and
separate.
Difference. I
and
think difference. Difference in general, so ethnic difference, cultural difference. I think that all the things that you named as problematic and as of in the way of peace, Kant mentions them and says they are tools by nature in an interesting way.
That will lead eventually to a state that, once we've completely exhausted all of our differences or have been dispersed to the point where we can no longer escape one another, then supposedly that's the moment that we're forced to make, you know, to come to peace. So what do you think about that?
I think, to go back to what you said, I think there's a way in which, if I heard you correctly, if I kind of was hearing you for what you were trying to say, there's a way in which peace is often seen as an instrument or a strategy today in the name of some form of collectivity.
Mm-hmm.
You use peace to get there. And if I was hearing you correctly, you were talking for a more individuated understanding of peace that's not just a tactic or a strategy or instrumentalized. And that's last night when I mentioned this political scientist, Uday Mehta, that I was interested in thinking through the work of, and his work on Gandhi. He was arguing that that was something that Gandhi was committed to, not using peace as a political tactic in the name of a nationalism or some form of collectivity, but as a state of being, in a way, within oneself.
I mean, I think that you have to start at the individual level. You can't just, to even have a discussion between societies, you have to have one individual, or more than one individual, hopefully, to move towards having that dialogue. And I think that I think a lot of conflict kind of emerges from this either like dichotomy between, you know, one person's peace and another person's goals or peace, and then I don't know. I think it's very important. Like, I don't think you can have a global society that lives peacefully together unless every individual kind of embodies this idea of peace. Because if not, there's always going to be that one person who can start a revolution, who can start a war. You know, all it takes is one person with an idea to create a movement that leads to violence. But if everyone kind of internalizes this, you know, this moral code, this movement towards their version of peace, ideally, everyone's idea of peace has something in common that will eventually lead us to that.
I don't know. I think this sounds a bit scary. If I think of everybody thinking in the same way, I kind of like then more that there's this one person who then starts a revolution. But that's maybe my antagonistic nature in this. But how would a world look like if everybody were? I mean, how would states look like? Would we have states? Would we have a system of international institutions?
It's important not to. Maybe I didn't make myself completely clear. Like, I don't mean that everyone should think the same and should have the same values.
I'm
and
just being provocative.
Yeah, no. But, you know, I think kind of going back to the purpose of this discussion, we all have different ideas of peace, but in the end, it's the same result. It's you know, this global society working together, trying to make the world a better place. And we all have different ideas. We all come from different backgrounds. We all have different religious, cultural practices. But that doesn't mean that we can't have this discussion.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what makes, you can keep going.
Oh, no,
like, our school, so, I mean, I feel like I'm running an experiment when I like think about our school and like all these ideas, because, I mean, you guys came here knowing we have this honor code and we have this Quaker background, and that we aren't a religious college, but we have these fundamentals that there is a religion that is guiding our understanding of peace here and our understanding of what it is. And, like, it's so weird to think about, like, we have peace here in the sense that we don't have law. Like, we govern ourselves. No one gets expelled from this school. You get removed from to an extent, you get removed from the community. Like, we are the ones who determine punishments to an extent, and that, like, we all have this idea of confrontation and respect, like trust, concern, and respect are like the three things of our honor code. And that is that we've created this whole idea of peace within each other. I mean, the fact that we're having this dialogue, I mean, it's one reason why I came to this school, is knowing that something like this could happen, and that you put 9 kids in a room and this is able to occur. And that I think it's just a weird concept to grasp that, are we creating peace in our own little bubble, like the Haverford bubble? Like, is this what peace is? Is this what we're striving for? That we help create the law. We help create how we want to see each other how do we interact with each other, all based on these ideas of respecting each other and moving in that direction.
I think that's true. There's a big diversity on our campus, I would say, between just, like, backgrounds and you know, gender and where people come from. I think that's all really different, and not saying that everybody on this campus sort of like believes in like the same thing exactly, or like has the same cultural beliefs or religious beliefs, but there's that sort of tolerance that I think is crucial to peace. Peace isn't necessarily believing in everything that another culture believes in, but it is tolerating it and respecting it and saying, this is what you believe, this is what I believe, let's move forward and respect each other, not necessarily change or assimilate to each other. And I think the moment you start trying to, you know, press your beliefs to somebody else, that's when you have a conflict. And I think the biggest conflict, the biggest deterrent from peace are the differences between people. And I think just respecting the humanity in everybody, that's something that we all have in common, is the best way to go forward.
I actually think that this campus is an incredible example of repression, personally.
You do.
I mean, I think this is, Haverford is the ultimate example of repressed peace, because, I mean, be a conservative on Haverford campus. I'm not, personally, but...
I am.
I mean, most Republicans that I know on this campus, they go around feeling like they're in a zoo. They feel like their beliefs don't really matter on this campus. They feel like they're constantly being exposed. And personally, I come from Texas, and I have to hear slights about my state every day. And you talk about tolerance, that's exactly what it is. It's tolerance. It's not understanding. Peace comes, the idea of not repressed peace comes through understanding. And people on this campus, we talk about trust, concern, and respect, but we don't actually go to the effort to understand what we're respecting. It's not very Haverford not to be very rah-rah about the school, but it's like calling Haverford a great example of peace, it's more an example of repression, because we don't actually try to comprehend each other. We talk about how much we respect other cultures, and there's just this sort of superficial veneer to how we do it.
I think that's a personal choice, personally. I mean, you as a person can choose whether you want to take that approach or you want to delve deeper. I think that's true, is that there are people who do that and do the like, well, I'm just gonna like accept your idea, but then that's your personal choice, and is that considered like peace, accepting what you do? I mean, that idea that you brought up of like tolerance, I think that's a really big issue, that you have tolerance, acceptance, embracing. You gotta eventually move forward, but tolerance is a step. I mean, I think we don't have the ideal, but that if there's tolerance, that's going somewhere, and that's better than nothing, and that accepting and like hearing and bringing that up is the first step in moving in a direction, is making people understand that there is an issue and that needs to be resolved. I think
the kind of to agree with Allison, I'm sorry, I forget your name.
Mariah,
sorry. I thought it was really interesting what you said, because you first used tolerance and respect interchangeably, and then you switched to respect. And I think it's a very important distinction between tolerance and respect, because tolerance is kind of what Lowell's describing, which is merely just like saying, okay, well, you can do your own thing, but like, I don't really care that much, but I'm going to deal with it. And respect is more of what we're doing here, I think, which is engaging in this conversation and, you know, bringing up these issues. And as someone who really admires and respects when people challenge my ideas, I think
that peace is not only, this ability to tolerate and respect, but also to confront, like kind of how we had at Haverford. But the important difference is to be able to confront in a respectful way, in a way that does not lead to conflict, be it moral conflict or armed conflict. And this kind of goes back to what I was saying earlier, which is that, you know, we all have our different ideas and we're going to disagree. But if we can discuss, kind of agree to disagree, you know, discuss our differences and realize that we have different beliefs, but in the end, if we're working towards peace, we kind of all want the same thing.
How do you move beyond, because I've heard the word dialogue many times, how do you move beyond the state of mere toleration, of the state of not a superficial, but let's say just a conditional and a conditional kind of understanding. You don't want to understand too much about the other person.
Right.
You just want to understand enough to be able to tolerate, for you to be able to live together and so forth. But is that kind of, if we think about it now on a global scale, how do we extend this kind of Haverford? How could Haverford become a globalized city? I mean,
should
you can't get the whole. How should they?
I think it starts at the individual level. I think it's interesting, just going off of, Nora said. I didn't necessarily really agree with you at first, but then I watched our conversation go from a very broad, like global, to school, to Haverford,
mm-hmm.
and I think we're back at the individual again. Like, it starts and ends with the individual. So I think it's an individual effort. And I've actually agreed with you since. Yeah.
Is it dialogue, though? Is it actual communication, individual to individual, that will lead to that place of understanding? I'm interested in this notion of understanding.
Well, I think with Haverford, what's interesting is that while we are diverse in a lot of superficial ways, if you will, we are homogenous in terms of ideology. A lot of times it is predominantly liberal here. There are, you know, conservatives. And also, it's also self-selecting in that we choose to come to the school because of the honor code and because we agree with those values of respect, tolerance, and concern. And the world is not homogenous like we are in mindset.
Nor can you choose to be born into a particular community.
No.
Or the other.
No. And
can
so
just somebody explain, because I'm not even American, so for me this is fascinating. There is an honor code about trust, tolerance.
It's a Quaker system. It's
But I and how does it work?
Just
quickly explain.
You know, when you come to the school, you understand that there's this honor code that we all abide by,
mm-hmm.
and it's just that we respect everyone. We don't, you know, like, we govern ourselves.
It's really hard to explain. It's like the, like,
what if
I mean,
I
give tours and I try to like explain to prospective students, and I'm just like.
It really is like a mindset, though. Like, we're talking about.
Let's say
mindset.
I were a student, and I would, and you would all think I would break this honor code. I would say something very intolerant or something. What would happen to
then
me?
Then we confront you, and we,
right?
and we you know, tell you why this, you know, that it's not following the honor code. And
what if I say, well, I think you are all breaking the honor code?
If the confrontation isn't settled, you go before an honor council.
Right.
Honor council, which is half people who are elected to the actual honor council and half randomly selected jury.
Right.
And
these are still all students.
It's all students.
Yeah.
So there's no supervisor kind of authority figure who comes in and lays down the law.
Right. It's kind of your representatives, in a sense, that then decide on the issue, and they come up with a final decision, or is there appeal to it?
I don't think you can really appeal an honor council decision. I've never heard of it happening. But
so they establish then whoever what is
they investigate, they hold a trial, they determine how to reintegrate the individual into the community.
Kind of like the sovereign, like we kind of elect them and say we because they're students that we've said okay you can do this, and so we kind of say we trust you to make the right decision in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, it's just this idea that you're supposed I feel like the best way to, in the classroom, it manifests itself in this idea that you, the only way you learn why you believe something is through understanding the other side. And that's how you can affirm your beliefs and say why you believe that, and that is what we try to gain from each other.
Yeah, but I mean, just like being the provocateur here, what if, let's say, there is a group of students, of 20 students.
And he's the practical politician.
And 19 of them just don't abide by the code of honor, and one does. And now these 19 pressure this one into believing their set of, let's say, 19 Republicans and one liberal. I mean, is it like majority-based, or can the individual then...
Well, everything we do is by consensus.
Yeah.
Consensus, right.
The goal is to get us to sacrifice, to communicate to a point where we can all be satisfied with something.
So now you said something that really fascinates me, because there's been a lot of talk about understanding communication. I've been wondering if that's Haverford, or if this is you, or, you know, trying to piece this together. It's very interesting. But you said communication demands sacrifice. So communicating enough, then you have to sacrifice your own pets. You risk sacrificing your own point of view by communicating more.
Not necessarily your own point of view. Because, I mean, you can stand outside of consensus. What is it? You can have, like, one person outside of consensus, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, I think the dialogue doesn't sacrifice your own point of view, even if you end up agreeing to something.
To be outside.
Right. Or even if you agree to it, but you don't. But maybe in the beginning you started out in a different spot. I think it fosters a sort of understanding, and maybe what you were disagreeing with in the beginning you've realized is not such a big deal. Or through conversation and through understanding, you've realized that I can live with this. It's not exactly what I thought it was.
Just like Justin was like, I didn't agree with Nora in the beginning.
Right.
Prime example right here, guys. Wasn't staged. No.
I wonder if this is
like he was like, he moved to this point through the dialogue.
I wonder if this is like one of the fundamental precepts of what Kant calls universal cosmopolitanism, which is this stage, slow stage of multiplying opportunities for multicultural, let's say, encounters, is the right of the universal right of the stranger to enter, to communicate. And in the German, it's Verkehr, right? The intercourse, to have intercourse, commercium. He believes that the more contact globally between strangers, the more condition, that will condition eventually what you're calling understanding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's interesting that we're talking about the honor code, because I feel like while it is often seen as a very idealistic thing, and Haverford is called the Haver bubble, where we're on campus and we have sort of a different mindset than we have off campus. But I think that the general principles of the honor code really could be applied to more of a global level. Like, for instance, the idea of confrontation, not a physical confrontation, but more of a respectful discussion of the differences between one person and another. And it's not even necessarily that one person is right and the other is wrong, because in many of our conflicts today, that's just an oversimplification. But I
think it's, and I think we have only a few
sounds
more
like
minutes
the UN to me.
Left. Yeah, exactly. I was going to say. I mean, I think it's fascinating to come up with this idea of what could the world learn from Haverford, and in what way could I don't know. For example, the United Nations be changed. I think the United Nations would like to change. Everybody's talking about how to reform the United Nations and how to reform the international
maybe the United system. Nations needs an honor code.
But I mean, yeah, in practical terms, do you think there is something one could change in international affairs or ways of conducting them, which could be inspired by such ideas?
Martin, you're effectively asking, could we scale up, or could we apply methodologically
what is
the case here on a larger level, or is it by definition something that could only happen in this kind of intimate arrangement?
Bubble. Could it only be in a bubble, or can you think of that bubble as a global bubble?
The people need to be willing.
Right.
That's kind of what Kate was saying. Like, we choose to be here. You have to sign an agreement that you will follow the honor code before
when you
Okay,
apply.
So then this would only work as if we could actually inhabit another planet and people could elect to go to that planet.
No, I think it works through trust. Through trust within a society, trust with society to government, trust with government to government. I think that's what it happens through. I mean, it would happen a lot faster if we could just go to, like, Mars and everybody who wants to follow the Haverford Honor Code can just go there. But I think that it can happen on a global level. I think it's just slower because we have these different, we have these barriers and we have the dishonesty that we're combating right now. But I think working through that, the trust is really what makes the Haverford Honor Code work.
What would you tell Obama and Ahmadinejad and Hugo Chavez, who were about to sit together on a table to discuss their relations? What would they need to bear in mind before starting such a conversation?
With the understanding that there's been an utter breakdown of trust.
Yeah.
It's already happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's difficult. I don't know that I have the answer, but I think they need to start off with, you know, respecting one another, and not only one another, but the people that they're representing, the people that the other countries are representing, because I think it's easy to look at a person as an entity of the country and not necessarily the millions of people that you are affecting. And I think that goes back to the humanity, and that is a vast oversimplification of what needs to happen. But I think that sort of mindset, going in with that mindset, is beneficial.
I'm fascinated with the Haverford model. I think that if leaders of countries could be subjected to the honor code, okay, then all of the leaders would go and confront him right now and about their disagreements, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then if there was a disagreement remaining, then there would be an honor council elected that would determine the situation at that moment.
Is the universal charter, the UN Charter of Human Rights, is that such a thing as an honor code? I mean, states have signed it. And
mm-hmm. I don't know. I was thinking about that. What I'm realizing is that the difference here at Harvard is we elect to come here and there already is an honor code in place that we agree with. Whereas in the world, if we're trying to, you know, create an, you know, honor code system, there's already these pre-existing ideologies that we then have to, you know, form a consensus between. And I think that's where the issue comes up, is that even if we did have this respect, and I mean, you know, we have to come to some kind of consensus, and that's more difficult when there's such a much more diverse realm of ideas than there is at Harvard.
But Martin was asking, like, isn't there in fact already an honor code in existence, which is the UN Charter?
Yeah, and I guess, yeah, going, or addressing that, I guess, yeah, we've tried to form a consensus. I think there's some parts of, like, I'm not, like really familiar with it, but obviously there's still human rights violations.
Yeah.
And so there's
some, so there's effective disagreement.
Yeah. And so it's like we've had, you know, I guess they have had to make it general enough in some parts.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of avoids the issue of addressing these specific human rights violations.
There's also a lot of discussion on the far left saying that that charter is insufficient. It's not detailed enough.
Yeah.
It does not address all.
I want to just, I don't know, because we're at the closing, I want to say that I think it's fascinating, this discussion, and I don't know whom to credit, and maybe there are a lot of, all of them are to credit, whether it's Kant's text that inspired such a discussion, whether it's Haverford, or whether it's all of you, and I think it's all of them, because I thought it was quite amazing that this text led to you not only bringing up Haverford, which I think you have every reason to be proud of, but also to put it fundamentally into question, which I think you should also be very proud of, that this is happening. And I think I personally agree that that philosophy in general and Kant's text has this potential, should bring us to question ourselves at first, and that enables us to take on such big and general and global challenges as world peace, and I learned in that sense a lot from you, and want to congratulate you for that.
Thank you.